During campaigns, Harper was asked if the government's delaying of funds to Planned Parenthood International was a sign of conservative action on abortion to come. Harper denied that he would support any action to change the status of abortion, yet both pro-choice and pro-life advocates alike have been calling this an empty statement. There are currently 106 known anti-choice or pro-life MPs in the House of Commons, according to the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. 102 of these are members of the Conservative Party. Since 1987, 43 private members' bills have been introduced that would limit the provision of abortion services in the country. In the last 10 years, these bills have all been introduced by Alliance, Reform, Liberal, or Conservative MPs. In the past 5 years, bills have been introduced to criminalize abortions and to limit access through checkpoints and availability at healthcare providers. Pro-choice groups are also concerned about the potential for defunding of abortion and reproductive health services, as has been seen in the U.S. political sphere over the last year. The Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada also cites a possibility of action in the Senate, Supreme Court, or public policy sphere through the appointment of more pro-life judges, senators, and ministers. Harper has signed on to a G8 initiative in support of improving maternal and child health care in poorer nations. The Conservatives have been heavily promoting this move as a priority of the government, yet critics across the mainstream media and in local communities are asking why they're only hearing about it now, and calling on Harper not to isolate maternal and children's health from the larger institutional problems that cause deficiencies in these areas. It is unlikely sexual health or abortion services will improve under the Conservatives, despite a dire need for such services in northern and rural areas. There is no registered abortion provider in PEI, and only one in all of New Brunswick.
We need the Conservatives!
Nesky Manuel, a band counselor and community radio host, has been missing more than a month. David Parker from CKDU in Halifax updates us with the search for Nesky.
I'm Nesky Manuel. I'm Suquamish from the Nisqually community.
Have you seen Nesky Manuel? The Nisqually band counselor has been missing since May 8th and was last seen on his family's property near Chase in the interior of British Columbia. The search has been extended across North America. Listeners of Campus Community Radio may have heard Nesky's voice on Groundwire or other NCRA syndicated shows. Here is a clip.
So what kind of writing systems are available like in Native North American cultures?
A search team has searched Nisqually Lake using side-scan sonar and found no substantial clues, which means there is a possibility that he is somewhere else. In the past, Nesky has traveled extensively across Canada by bicycle. Nesky is a native male, 30 years old. He is about 6 feet tall and weighs 180 pounds. He has a short haircut and brown eyes. At the time of his disappearance, Nesky was wearing glasses, blue jeans, gray sweater, and dark Nike running shoes, which may have an orange Nike swoosh on the sides. If you have seen him or know his whereabouts, you can call the tip line set up by Nesky's family at 1-855-637-8477 or 1-855-NES-TIPS.
Protests against shale gas extraction have been picking up in different parts of Canada. Many communities and environmentalist groups object to the extraction protests involved in shale gas extraction, which is done by hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Fracking is done by drilling deep wells into the ground, injecting a mixture of millions of gallons of water, sand, and chemicals. This injection creates fissures deep within the earth, which cause a mini earthquake that then releases the natural gas. In communities in the United States where fracking has occurred, cancer rates have risen significantly, and often tap water becomes undrinkable due to contamination of the watershed. In Quebec, a group of activists from Moratoire d'une Génération participated in a month-long walk from Rimouski to Montreal to protest the shale gas extraction plans of the Jean Charest government. They are expected to arrive in Montreal on June 18th, with a protest planned outside the Hydro-Québec headquarters. And in New Brunswick, an environmental network has formed to attempt to stop the provincial government from engaging in similar practices. Dallas McQuarrie is a resident of St. Ignace and an activist with Banned Fracking NB.
And we're a tourist province, you know, like tourism is big here. Nobody ever went to holiday in a gas field. You don't move to a gas field to raise your family. I don't understand the thinking that could say just flushing big tracts of New Brunswick down the toilet makes any sort of sense economically.
Campaigns against fracking have already begun in Nova Scotia and Ontario as well. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio, Montreal.
Melva Flynn is a community radio station manager who is about to change professions. She's a student in Quebec's first pilot project for training highly skilled, licensed practical nurses.
The professional licensing in Quebec has been overhauled in the last few years with Bill 90, specifically defining the roles and responsibilities and the obligations of all professional orders, and that includes your nursing assistants, your odontologists, your radiologists, your dentists, lawyers, accountants, everyone who are members of a professional order. Everybody is getting kind of slid around a little bit. So the LPNs, or the licensed practical nurses, have been taking on some new duties, such as venipuncture, taking drawing blood, catheterization, gastrointestinal tubing, setting up IV lines, stuff that 5 years ago was never unheard of, even medications, distributing medications to patients and stuff, which traditionally has been the role of an RN.
As Quebec's registered nurses relinquish tasks to licensed practical nurses, they in turn will gain powers formerly reserved for doctors, such as diagnosis and prescription. The new responsibility comes with a heavy training burden. The Interprofessional Health Federation of Quebec notes some concern that license changes could be driven more by cost-cutting than by public health. But in rural areas, says Melva Flynn, the new responsibilities are needed.
I know within Quebec, just within my region alone, there are 5 or 6 community clinics where doctors just visit like once a month. So the nurses who are on staff there are normally on the phone with the doctors. What do I do? Can I do this? They know what to do. They know how to do it. It's just that the last call always came down to the doctor. Now the nurses can take that responsibility, and it cuts out a lot of red tape. It cuts out a lot of phone calls. The patients get treated a lot faster. They can be sent out for further treatment if necessary. It makes things a lot easier. It makes the healthcare system go a little smoother.
This report was co-produced by Laura Yaros of CINQ Montreal and Frieda Worden of CJSF Burnaby, BC.
Now it's time for a short music break.
Shallow waters, I can't see your clear waves lapping at my feet. The lifeless ocean, black, not blue. I didn't help but deep down I knew. To see dolphins playing in front of me, the seaweed swaying, keeping time, tidal rhythms, laugh not cry. Oh, 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 why do tears fall from the sky? Oh, 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 we give
That was Shallow Waters by Takaya Blaney, a 10-year-old girl from the Slimen Nation in British Columbia.
Now it's time for our feature stories. Slutwalk started in Toronto and has spread across the world. Aaron Lakoff speaks to Emily La Liberté and Eli Darling at Slutwalk Montreal.
I'm Emily La Liberté. I'm the general director of Stella, a sex worker organization in Montreal. Whenever a sex worker press charge for a sexual assault, she's being put down because of the work she chose. And we are here to denounce the aggression that keeps on happening on sex worker. We are here to denounce as well the fact that we don't have protection yet. I mean, there was the jugement that went out in Ontario on September 28th, and it was actually the Susan Email, the judge, who decided to decriminalize all the article regarding sex work. And so she said it is so urgent to actually decriminalize right now in Canada. It's the laws are so risky for sex workers that the judgment is going to apply right now. And it took only 2 hours for the federal government of Harper to actually do an appeal of that judgment. And so we're going to hear the Court of Appeal in June, and hopefully it will be the Bedford case, which is the Jugement Bell, will be endorsed by the Supreme Court, so it's applied to all Canada. Because right now, I mean, the fact that we have a criminal status is like an open call for aggressors. You know, you can go and rape sex workers. They don't have protection, and a lot of aggression take place right now.
Can you just kind of tell me what Harper has basically been saying about sex work and how you feel about that?
Well, he actually said that he didn't have the responsibility to protect sex workers because they were asking for violence. They were exposing themselves to violence by choosing to do sex work. And so it's kind of traumatizing as a sex worker to hear that and to see that the government don't see me as a full citizen with all the rights that, you know, any other citizen have.
My skirt is not an invitation.
My name's Eli, and I'm a sex worker, and I'm also a transsexual man. One of the things, actually, that I wanted to challenge today is something that I hear a lot in trans communities is people saying that, you know, like, I've made it because I'm trans and I'm not a sex worker. And I think that, you know, people don't gain anything from that. And it's really a shame that trans people who do engage in sex work are cast aside like that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what you're seeing here today and how it makes you feel.
It's really amazing for me to see all those people, you know, from all kinds of different backgrounds.
In Halifax, Annabelle Koo from CHRY in Toronto speaks to Elle Jones.
If we continue to treat it from, I guess, the sort of mainstream liberal approach, which is that, you know, let the courts take care of it, or that is what sort of leads to it being treated as an individual crime. And so it's rather than looking at it as specifically directed violence and something that is a result of sexism, and that I think you could read as part of, you know, the genocide against women that is a specific to our society as well. And I think it's important to acknowledge that in order to solve it, because as long as we continue to think that it's just, you know, some bad men, that doesn't reach at the roots of the problem. And also its intersectionalities, so that gender violence, we understand it intersects with race, it intersects with poverty, it intersects with disability. So, you know, we can't just talk about it as gender, we have to talk about it as class, race, all of those things, because the more marginalized women are, the more vulnerable they are, the less likely they are to receive justice, the less likely they are to be able to put into words what has happened to them, to have that acknowledged. So we rarely see women of color raped, unless it's sort of an othering thing, like, okay, it's so horrible in Congo when women get raped, but we don't look at what's happening to, say, women of color. So we talk about sex trafficking, right? But we don't talk about the young women of color who are being trafficked in North America, because nobody wants to look at that. So I think it's important to recognize those issues and understand them from a systematic response, and also to look at our own solutions outside of what we've been offered.
Gennardi O'Sullivan speaks with Dr. Roland Christian about the Residential Schools Agreement, the Truth and Reconciliation Process, and the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous Peoples.
My name is Gennardi O'Sullivan, and I'm a Kwakwaka'wakw. I'm speaking with Dr. Roland Christian, who is a member of the Oneida Nation of the Confederacy of Haudenosaunee Iroquois. What are your views on the residential school agreement?
It treats an act of genocide on the part of the Canadian government as something that you can buy and sell at a meat market. In other words, if you got raped, well, you were entitled to so much. If you broke a bone, you got so much for that. If somebody yelled at you, you got so much for that, and so on. And the idea was just to pay off people for their individual injuries. What we lose sight of in this whole business of commodifying personal injury is that it wasn't, residential school wasn't a personal injury. It was a genocidal attack on us collectively. If we look at the residential school just as a residential school, you miss a whole bunch of other things that are going on simultaneously, like the 60s scoop and the 70s scoop. If you don't consider the full range of policies that were arrayed against First Nations people, if you only look at them one at a time, then you try to deal with them one at a time, but you lose the fact that it was a consistent policy across a whole range of what looked to be different activities. And you lose the fact that there's a coherence here. Canada really did have an agenda, and that agenda is unquestionably genocide. So the idea is that let's have this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and then Indians who want to complain about what happened in the residential school, they can come up and they can complain. They each get their 15 minutes. We can look concerned, but we're not actually going to do anything on the basis of any of the evidence that they bring. I mean, they might write a book, but people may not be aware of this. There are something like 10,000 pages of testimony in the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples report, about 10,000 pages of people testifying about what happened in residential school. Did anything change as a result of those 10,000 pages? I can't see anything that changed. People got up and they talked, and they talked with the idea that it would bring about some kind of change. But the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People changed absolutely nothing.
All right. Now, can we move on to the United Nations Declaration and your views on the United Nations Declaration and what it means for First Nations people in Canada, if anything at all?
Well, for one thing, Canada has already removed itself from consideration of what its crimes actually are. Again, it's going through a process where it's pretending to turn over control to First Nations people, but it isn't. So Canada has insulated itself from criticism, and it resisted. It, by the way, it changed drastically. The earlier versions of the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous People were a lot stronger than the last than the version that was finally endorsed. And the primary movers for those changes were Canada and the United States, because they were the ones that would be most susceptible to attack. New Zealand, you'll also note, and Australia were also susceptible to this kind of attack. Gee, if you turn that into law, the Aboriginal people will be able to sue us left, right, and center, and we don't want that to happen. So they were holdouts all the way. As near as I can tell, it's going to make no difference. In other words, it's neutral. So it's more like a public relations action that Canada has finally decided that it's, oh, okay, we can endorse it now.
Galakasla.
Thanks.
Big smile perched up a sad posture, dogged sunshine in the dead of winter. Tangle fangs underneath your smooth skin, fresh bold words and a shaking chin. Did you really get on that plane just to rise above pain, only to find yourself beneath the bumper of a car outside of Queen Street Bar, drunk with blood and rain? Your big blue eyes, they're so well-meaning that they can't match what they want to see with what they're seeing. So they stare right through you to another dimension till you can't even recognize your own intention. Did you really get on that plane just to rise above pain, only to find yourself beneath the bumper of a car outside of Queen Street Bar?
That was Blood and Rain by The Pining from their new self-titled album.
On Tuesday, June 14th, the Canada Post Corporation began a nationwide lockout of all striking postal workers, suspending mail operations across the country after 12 days of rotating strikes from its 48,000 unionized urban workers.
My name's Holly. I'm from the Graduate Students Association of Concordia University, representing the association. There's a lot of Concordia students here, a lot of McGill students here. We support you. We have the same problems. We have the same struggle. I think Joel talked about that. I just want to add a little bit something about the narrative that's going on. I study media. I study propaganda. Let's talk about this statement that there is no money. We're in a recession and there's no money. And so all you people, all you students, all you working people have to give money to rich people because they don't have enough anymore. There's a lot of money. This is an incredibly rich society. We need to stop that narrative. Everywhere we hear it, there's a lot of money. There's money for decent jobs. There's money for education. And hey, there's a lot of money for jets and wars and prisons. Every year, $400 million goes to private schools in the Montreal region and Quebec. So, and then there's no money for education. There's a lot of money for rich people, and we need to start recognizing that.
On Wednesday, June 15th, Labor Minister Lisa Raitt informed the House of Commons that she was tabling notice of intention to introduce back-to-work legislation, meaning the bill could be up for a vote next week. In a statement on their website, CUPW has called the legislation unnecessary, unjust, and counterproductive. Aaron Lakoff spoke with Ruth Breen, a postal worker in Fredericton, New Brunswick.
What's at stake here is the collective agreement that we've had in place for 40 years. Some of the concessions that Canada Post is looking for were in CUPW's very first collective agreement that was reached in 1968, which really means the concessions they're looking for take us back to our pre-organized work conditions. And what I'm speaking of here is the attack on our sick leave. And this is something that's been happening for a number of years. Canada Post has brought in an attendance management system that has harassed workers for taking advantage of their sick leave and encouraged workers to come to work sick and work in unhealthy conditions. So what they're trying to do is take that a step further with actually changing our collective agreement rights around sick leave.
Despite the fact that Canada Post has made a profit for the past 16 years, the corporation has insisted on concessions from the union and has refused multiple offers from the union over the course of 7 months of negotiations. David Parker spoke with Canadian Union of Postal Workers Nova Local President Trevor Beckerson in Halifax.
We were locked out just after midnight on Wednesday the 15th. This was over Canada Post's stalwart refusal to negotiate fairly. We have been negotiating since October of 2010. The key issues have been over health and safety, improper staffing, a new sick leave plan that gives the employer the ability to overrule anything your doctor might say, and reduced wages and 5 years more for new workers before they can earn a pension. The public support has been outstanding. I know and the postal workers know that the public supports our struggle and that the public does not favor back-to-work legislation. The postal workers are here and ready to work. It's up to the government now.
CUPW has a long history of standing up for women's rights, civil rights, social justice, and peace. The union was the first to secure paid maternity leave for its workers, a right won after a 42-day strike in 1981. CUPW was also the first union in Canada to boycott South African apartheid and to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israeli apartheid. Denis Lemelin, CUPW national president, spoke on Wednesday, June 15th, about the proposed back-to-work legislation, saying, quote, "An imposed settlement brings down terms that neither party has agreed to. We believe in free speech, free association, and free collective bargaining. This legislation hurts the values that our country stands for and is an attack on workers' rights and standard of living." End quote. The question that remains is how CUPW's fight will affect workers across Canada as deeper austerity measures imminently approach with the new Conservative budget. My name is Fraser McPherson, reporting for Groundwire.
Now it is time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report.
Hi, my name is Christine Comrie from CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, and at the National Campus Community Radio Conference in Halifax, I asked the women delegates what women in radio means to them.
My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan. I'm originally born in Alert Bay. I'm Kwakwaka'wakw from the Tlaalitsis Nation. I'm from Vancouver at Co-op Radio, CFRO, and CJSF. And being a First Nations woman in radio means that we've progressed as a people and are able to communicate with our people and help them, our people, to progress as well.
I'm Palmier Boutillier in Halifax, and I would describe women in radio as relatable and somebody that I can maybe trust.
Hi, I'm Brenda from CITR in Vancouver, and I think campus radio can sometimes be about a lot of dudes playing vinyl, which I love, but I think we need more women on the radio.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Richardson, and I'm the host of Latin Waves. Women in radio means for me empowerment, but the kind of power that creates. Women in radio for me means diversity, the kind of diversity of voices, the kind of multiple views, and creating a world that has multiple focus where we actually come together and create something better than what we have.
Hi, my name is Ashley. I'm from CHRW in London, Ontario. And women in radio means a lot to me. At my station, I feel very comfortable and welcomed there because there is such a great representation. It's definitely a thing that is an ongoing issue because there are other places that women aren't fairly represented. And I feel really lucky that I can do what I love and I'm taken seriously for it.
Hi, I'm Melissa from Halifax. And I would describe women in radio as just a different perspective on the radio, and you probably want to listen into it.
Hi, my name is Grace. I'm from CITR 101.9 FM out of UBC in Vancouver, and I think women in radio rock because I'm one of them, and I'm happy to be here at the NCRA conference.
Oh, hi, I'm Frida Worden from Women's International News Gathering Service. When I think of women in radio, I think of innovation, passion, and skill.
Hi, I'm Heidi Griffin from CHMA in Sackville, New Brunswick. To me, women in radio at the local level means being able to sit at home with my tea and listen to someone that I might not know and hear some of their most intimate views and their favorite music. It's a great opportunity to meet new people, but it also just gives women a voice in their community and helps them build self-confidence and discover new things.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire from the NCRC in Halifax. Thanks for tuning in. We also thank Gennarji O'Sullivan, Candace Moores, Annabelle Koo, Christine Comrie, David Parker, Ray Dooley, Aaron Lakoff, Frida Worden, Laura Yaros, Gretchen King, and Fraser McPherson. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This song is what we know. Oppression is a crime and it must go.
You're listening to CFRU FM 93.3 from University of Guelph.
Women of the world, stand up and fight. Now is the time to claim our rights. Color's not an issue in this fight. Doesn't matter if you're black or white.
This song is for liberty.
Organizing the most fantastic event in the history of Guelph, but afraid no one knows to come? Posted on CFRU 93.3 FM's community events listing, now online at www.cfru.ca.
Action Read Community Literacy Center is looking for new volunteer tutors. 4 out of 10 people aged 16 to 65 struggle with reading, writing, math, and other essential skills.
Many adults here in Guelph are looking for support in reading job postings, calculating budgets, applying for benefits, and participating in community life.